Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, we are discussing now the sutta number 27 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Chulahati Padopama Sutta, the simile of the elephant's footprint. And last time I discussed the passage on the abandoning of the five hindrances. And now I have to explain a little bit the concept of abandoning. This is a very important concept in Buddhism, since you could say like one of the main themes of the Buddha's teaching is the abandoning of the defilement. And now when we speak about defilement, according to Buddha psychology, Buddha psychology speaks about the defilement existing at three levels of the mind. Here in this class, I'm going to be throwing a lot of Pali terms at you. But it's important, I'm going to also give the English equivalent, but it's important to get these terms down and to understand them, because these terms and concepts, they give a very useful and quite an intricate map for understanding the terrain of the Buddha's teaching. Okay, so we have three, what I call a threefold layering of the defilement. Okay, the coarsest level of defilement is called vitikamma, which can be translated active expression. This is where a defilement actually motivates bodily, some kind of defiled bodily or verbal action. Then a subtler level of the defilement's action is called pariyutana, which means it might be translated mental obsession, but if that's too strong, you could even call it the arising of a defilement into the mind. It's the stage where the defilement is active in the thought process, in one's mental thought process. And then the subtlest level of defilement is called anusaya, the anusaya level, the anusaya stage. The word anusaya is often translated latent tendency or sometimes underlying tendency. It comes from the stem is baya, which means lying, like lying down. Verb sati, to lie down. And anu means along with. So these are the defilements when they're not, they don't have to be active. They can be very quiet, like they're sleeping, but they're lying dormant in the very deep layers of the mind, so that we might not be even aware of them. But the defilements are lying there, and in this stage, the defilements, we can say, follow us from life to life. And now the different stages of the Buddha's training are intended to counteract and eradicate the defilements at these different levels. So to counteract the defilements in the stage of active expression, we have the training in virtue, which is undertaken by precepts and sense restraint. Okay, so one counteracts the active expression of the defilement, the expression through bodily and verbal action, by undertaking precepts, by sense restraint, by the various observances that are called sila, often translated as virtue. But even though one is observing precepts, restraining the senses, still the defilements can remain active in the mind. One is still thinking unwholesome thoughts. The mind is still obsessed by unwholesome emotions, troubled by called the five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry and doubt. So to overcome the defilements in the stage of mental obsession or disturbing thought processes, one develops samadhi, that is concentration, in order to purify the mind, to achieve a pure, clear, focused, one-pointed mind. It's called samadhi. It's defined as kusala cittase kagata, that is wholesome, one-pointed mind. And so that wholesome, one-pointed mind is a mind in which the defilements have been removed. But even though the defilements are removed in samadhi, they're not eradicated, not eliminated. To eliminate the defilements, one still needs to go to, even though the defilements have been removed at the surface level, but still they are still dwelling in the underlying depths of the mind, at the level of anusaya, the underlying tendencies, the latent tendencies. And so to eradicate the defilements at the level of the latent tendencies, then one needs wisdom, panya, or prajna. And it's only prajna which is able to penetrate into the very deep levels of the mind and to cut out the defilements right at their root level, right at their that very stage where they are rooted in the very substratum of the mind. Okay, now that takes us to the topic, or takes me to the topic of abandoning, when we speak about the abandoning of defilement, the abandoning of the hindrances. Now, in the passage that we had on the abandoning of the five hindrances, there come periods when the meditator is using specific techniques to temporarily overcome one of the hindrances. And we have technical terms for this way of dealing with the specific hindrances. I wish I didn't have to lay these technical terms on you, but there are no real adequate. First I lay the technical Pali terms, then I give English equivalents, then I explain. Okay, now the first was called Tad Anga Bahana. Anga means factor. Tad is actually tongue. That. So it's literally that factor abandonment. So we could say it's specific factor abandonment. Or I call it factorial abandonment. What this means is that one uses one particular factor to overcome an unwholesome state to which it is directly opposed. So, for example, a meditator is having the problem with sensual desire, so he uses the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body to overcome sensual desire. Or the meditator is having trouble with ill will and anger, so he uses the meditation on loving kindness, metta bhavana, to overcome that ill will and anger. Or one is having trouble with sloth and torpor, mental dullness and drowsiness. So one uses the perception of light to overcome that dullness and drowsiness. Or one is having trouble with restlessness and remorse. And so one takes a calming, peaceful object, like meditation on the breath, to calm the mind down. Or if one has skeptical doubt, then one uses a certain degree of reflection or analysis to overcome that doubt. And so one is here, one is using specific methods to eliminate specific troublesome, obstructive mental state. And it seems the paragraph number 18 is describing, in the initial stages, I would say, the way a meditator uses the... Here the meditator is probably beginning with a basic meditation object, like maybe the mindfulness of breathing, or since he's aiming for the jhanas, the absorptions, he might be taking one of the kasina objects, the Chinese, you call it. Shi, you had it last week. Shi, bian, chu. That's very close to the original Pali. Kasina yatana. Kasina yatana. Dasa kasina yatana, exactly. One of these colored discs or discs representing the four elements. But then as one goes on meditating on the breath or on the kasina object, various obstructive mental states come, and then one has to use, from time to time, one has to use these special medicines to overcome those mental states. Like from time to time to meditate on the 32 parts of the body, from time to time meditate on loving kindness, and in that way gradually one builds up the strength of meditative development so that those mental hindrances get weakened and the mind can remain on its object more and more consistently, until at a certain point the meditator will overcome the five hindrances completely and become able to remain persistently, consistently focused on the object. And when this happens in terms of the called the development of the object. The gross object will fall away, and then a subtle mental object appears to the mind. This is called this is really the proper object of concentration. It's not just the coarse object that one makes, the colored disc, but it's a mental replica of that disc. And it's not the actual breathing itself, but it's a very subtle object that appears based on the breath. This is called technically the nimitta, samadhi nimitta. There must be a Chinese equivalent for it. Do you know it? Sanchan, sanchan. Yeah. Okay, and so now the hindrances are abandoned and the mind is focused upon this very subtle object. And this is called now Vikambana Bahana. So it's the first stage of Vikambana Bahana, the stage of suppression abandonment. Now the hindrances subside. This is like compared to like a pool of water growing someplace in the jungle, and the person and the water is growing, overgrown with different types of water plants, and the person wants to take a drink. He's going through the jungle and he wants to take a drink of water. And so he uses his hands to push the jungle plants away so he could get some clear water to scoop up and drink. The jungle plants will still grow when he removes his hands. And so this suppression by abandonment, suppression, abandonment, it doesn't get rid of the defilements, but it keeps them away so they're not able to obsess the mind. And now what we're dealing with here when we speak about having thus abandoned these five hindrances in the beginning of paragraph 19, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, that would be the very first stage of suppression abandonment. In the commentaries, this stage, I wrote it last week. I'll take this off now. I'll keep that, but I'll write the term. Okay, in the commentaries, this stage is called access concentration or neighborhood concentration. That is, we're now getting into the neighborhood. We're approaching full concentration. So we haven't quite gotten into it yet. Now the five hindrances have been suppressed. The mind is the proper object of concentration has appeared. And the mind is able to sustain its attention upon that object of concentration, to sustain it consistently over a period of time without having the attention interrupted by stray, distracting thoughts. But still, the concentration, it's not really deep. And now for some meditators, they would be able to use this access concentration, this is my opinion, as a basis for then shifting over and developing insight meditation. But in this sutta, the Buddha wants to show the most direct path going all the ways to arhatship, to the final goal. I was thinking of an analogy for the map of the path given in this sutta. I'm thinking, in the domain of meditation, there are many, many different routes that one could take, many different avenues and streets, many different roads, routes. But it's like if one were to have, okay, a close-up map of New Jersey, you know, at a very close zoom-in focus. You would see like many little roads, many little streets, little towns, how to get from town A to town B using little roads, side streets, and so on. But if you take a map of the United States and then look at, or even the map of eastern, northeastern United States and look at New Jersey, all you see is Route 80, Route 287. You see Paterson, Newark, Jersey City, the Jersey Turnpike. You don't see Lafayette. You don't see Sparta. You don't see, probably you don't see Newton. Okay, so this is like that zoom out map of the path. You don't see all the intricate details, but just the main features. The most direct route, like Route 80 or Jersey Turnpike map of the path. And so now the Buddha is going to show the way the path goes through the jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4, then through the direct knowledges to the fruit of arahatship. Okay, so now we come from the abandoning of the five hindrances into the first jhana. Okay, now there are these four stages of deep concentration. These are the stages of concentration which are called the jhanas. The jhanas come from the verb jayati, which means to consider closely, to observe closely, to contemplate. And somehow this noun jhana originally came to mean just observation or close consideration, and then it came to be used by the Buddha, also by some other Indian philosophical systems, to mean specific states of deep absorption, deep meditative absorption. And now, even though it might be possible to go directly from access concentration to insight meditation, in access concentration, the five hindrances are not really well suppressed. But here the Buddha wants to show how the stages in which the hindrances are removed, suppressed, and really kept pushed far and far into the background. And he wishes to show also these particular states, because even though they're mundane, in the sense that they're in a sense mundane states, they're not states of nirvanic bliss, but still these were the states that the Buddha himself had entered during the period of his own quest for enlightenment. If you remember, and I'll just refer back, I'll refer back to this sutta. This was sutta number 36, which we studied last year, the Greater Discourse to Sacchika. It is on page 340. When the Buddha had been experimenting with these extreme ascetic practices for many years, 6 years, according to tradition, and he found they didn't lead to any kind of higher wisdom. Then he remembered an experience he had gone through as a child when his father was plowing the ground and he was sitting under a rose apple tree. Then just spontaneously, he was sitting there cross-legged, spontaneously he entered into a state of deep meditative absorption. And then he recalled this experience and the thought occurred to him, could this be the path to enlightenment? And then he was at first hesitant to experiment with that experience because that experience was pleasant. And as an ascetic, he thought one has to avoid pleasant experiences. But that was the dominant idea amongst the spiritual seekers, that pleasant experiences are dangerous. They're seductive. They're traps. They're sticking points of attachment. So we have to keep away from them. But when the Buddha reflected upon that experience, he realized that, he says, why should I be afraid of that pleasure, which has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? And then he concluded that I am not afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. And so then the Buddha, after he regained his strength, his bodily strength, then he entered into that state of the first jhana. And then from there he went through the successive jhanas until, on the basis of the jhanas, he was able to attain the higher knowledges and then to attain enlightenment. And so after his enlightenment as a teacher, then he frequently recommended the jhanas to his disciples as, first, as a way to overcome the hindrances, and then also because this is a higher pleasure, a higher happiness, so it's a way to draw the mind away from sensual happiness, sensual pleasure, and lead it to the pleasure, the bliss of enlightenment. Like sometimes people think that one has to avoid any kind of bliss of samadhi, since any kind of bliss is dangerous. But in fact, the Buddha is a skillful teacher, and he uses the higher pleasures, the higher type of happiness, as a means, because the mind is always seeking happiness, that's natural. So first, and in his ordinary condition, the mind seeks sensual happiness. So if one just says, withdraw from sensual happiness, sensual pleasure, but I'm not going to give you any other happiness, then the mind just dries out. But the Buddha uses the jhanas as a kind of meditative happiness. And then once one experiences the happiness of, even a little taste of the happiness of the jhanas, then it's so much more refreshing and blissful than sensual happiness that one doesn't want to enjoy sensual happiness anymore. And then once one really indulges in the bliss and joy and rapture and tranquility of the jhanas, then of course there's a danger. One can develop attachment to it. But then the Buddha will teach, cut off that attachment. First, one goes through the successive jhanas, leaving the lower jhana, reaching the higher jhana, the higher jhana, the higher jhana. Then one has to contemplate the jhanas themselves as anicca, impermanent, dukkha, unsatisfactory, insecure, anatta, not mine, not I, not myself. Then one gives up the attachment to the jhanas. Okay, so now we come to the first jhana. Okay, so now having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, this is a stock definition which occurs probably at least 10 times, maybe as many as 20 times in the Majjhima Nikaya. the themes, the compilers of the canon. Probably the Buddha himself used this stock definition. And so whenever the text explains the first jhana, always the same formula is used. So we have here a set, certain fixed phrases. First come the preconditions for entering the first jhana. One abandons the five hindrances. Then what says the same thing? Secluded from sensual pleasures. That's the objective barrier that one has to overcome. That is the external sensual pleasures. One has to remove oneself from them by leading a simple life, a detached life. And then secluded from unwholesome states. The unwholesome states are the internal obstacles, namely the five hindrances themselves. Then one enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by, here we have two separate mental factors, which are very similar, but still there are some differences. Yeah, okay. We speak of access concentration. I spoke of access concentration as a state in which the mind becomes well concentrated on the object. But still, access concentration, it's not yet a state of full concentration. And the difference is that in full concentration, the certain factors become strengthened to such a degree that they bring about, we might call, a quantum shift in the level of consciousness. They actually shift the mind to a different level of consciousness, so that it is no longer functioning on the ordinary sensory level, the level of this particular world in which we dwell. But the mind is now functioning on a level that corresponds to that of the rupa, the world of pure form. And what brings about that shift is the strengthening of certain factors, five factors, which are called the jhana factors, the factors of the jhana. Four of them are mentioned in the formula of the suttas. Okay, the first of these, which is translated here, is applied thought. And the use of the word thought is very unsatisfactory, because the word thought implies that we're thinking about this, thinking about that. But what is called vitakka is actually, it's a mental function which applies the mind to the object. So we could call it, I call it here, mental application. So in the jhana, there's no thinking going on, as we know thinking. One is not thinking about the object. This is good, this is bad. What am I going to do tomorrow? What am I going to do? What did I do yesterday? One is not even thinking about the object. One is not thinking in-breath, not thinking out-breath, not thinking blue, if it's a blue casino, not thinking earth, if it's an earth casino. But the vitakka is just the factor that applies the mind to the object. Metaphorically, it's said that it lifts the mind up and pushes it onto the object, places it onto the object. And its partner here is called vichara. The two often go together, though they're not quite inseparable. Vichara, here it's translated sustained thought. But later I've changed my translation to examination. Vichara is what examines the object. But again, this is not an examination in the sense of looking at the object, evaluating it, thinking this is good, this is bad, I like this object, I don't like this object. But it's just an inspection, what inspects the object. And so for attaining the first jhana, vitakka, what's called applied thought and sustained thought, are very active factors. And as the mind, as they work together, vitakka is applying the mind to the object, vichara sustaining the mind on the object, examining the object, then the mind becomes one-pointedly fixed on the object. That is this fifth factor. That's the factor of concentration itself. And as that concentration becomes stronger in the process of approaching the jhana, then there arises what's called piti, which I translate somewhat inadequately, rapture. But rapture, again, it doesn't quite hit the mark. Maybe it suggests too much excitement. I wonder whether elation might be a better rendering. Or even a joy, a sort of reserved for another Pali word. But joy also suggests something of the quality of piti. It's a kind of, there's an element of excitement in piti, an element of exuberance, exhilaration. Gladness, delight. And so it's relatively coarse compared to its partner, sometimes partner, called sukha. Sukha is the feeling of pleasure that accompanies the jhana, feeling of happiness, but it's actually more a feeling of pleasure. The commentaries, they try to illustrate the difference between piti and sukha using a simile. The simile is that of a man who is wandering through a desert for a long time. He's quite hot, thirsty. Only has his supply of food is running low. Then as he's going through, he comes across another man walking from the opposite direction. He asks whether there is an oasis anywhere nearby. And the man tells him, oh, just about 200 yards ahead, there's an oasis with a nice pond and palm trees, the fig trees, date trees. And so the man hears this. He becomes very happy and joyful. He starts walking, walking, walking. And before long, he sees just ahead of him the pond and the fig trees, date trees, plants growing, and he's very, very joyful and elated. Okay, that joy and elation that he experiences when he sees the pond right ahead, that is said to be like piti. Then he arrives at the oasis, he jumps into the pond, he bathes, drinks water, fills up his water bottles, eats some dates and figs, and fills his bags with various foodstuffs. Then he lies down under a tree and rests. That is said to be like sukha. Okay, this is a simile, and it's not perfect. There are some inadequacies. For one thing, the simile suggests that piti and sukha occur at different times, right? But actually, piti and sukha occur together. But if you just take the mental qualities, you could see that there's some relation to the mental quality. Piti has that sense of elation, excitement, exuberance. Whereas sukha is more relaxed, calmer, satisfied, it's a sense of satisfaction. Okay, and so now, even though the way I explain it, there's some sequence to the, as the process of approaching jhana occurs, there's some sequence in the strengthening of these factors, but when the jhana is attained, all of these five factors are present together, and all of them work together, focusing and plunging the mind into the object, so that the mind becomes completely immersed in the object, completely absorbed in the object. And if you remember now coming into the sutta, back to the sutta, we're following through the simile of the elephant's footprint. And the Buddha was trying to explain how the elephant's footprint is truly followed through in correctly, in detail. The person that he was speaking to gave a wrong simile of the elephant's footprint. He said that one has confidence in the Buddha, true confidence in the Buddha, but one sees the footprints of the Buddha, footprints of the Tathagata, because one sees that the Brahmins convert and become disciples of the Buddha, one sees the Kshatriyas become disciples of the Buddha, one sees the householders become disciples of the Buddha, and one sees ascetics become disciples of the Buddha. The Buddha says that's the wrong way of tracking down the Tathagata by his footprint. But now the Buddha says, see, this is now a real footprint of the Tathagata. Because now one is tracking the Tathagata by the process by which he himself achieved enlightenment. And that first footprint that the Tathagata left in his own quest for enlightenment was the first jhana. So this is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. And the reason why he wouldn't come to this conclusion, what would be a reason? Because the jhanas are teaching not unique to the Buddha's dispensation, the Buddhism. So other teachers could also teach the way to the jhanas. Maybe not the clearly and precisely as the Buddha, but there will be teachers outside who also teach the jhanas. And so one could be following the instructions of another teacher and reach the first jhana and still not, that would not be evidence that the Buddha is fully enlightened. Okay, maybe at this point then I will stop the exposition, and if there are any questions. Yeah, yeah. I have to say now, if you have all of these notes and you master these notes, you go to any temple in Sri Lanka and you bring up questions on these points, and the monks will say, wow, where is this person? This is stuff you don't get in any elementary textbook on Buddhism. I didn't actually come to the Sambhucheda Bahana yet. Yeah. Yeah. The first two, now I've explained factorial abandonment is the way the meditator in the initial stages is using specific remedies to deal with specific hindrances. Then once he's able to overcome these specific hindrances and then using the main meditation object to get into first access concentration, then into the jhanas, that will be suppression abandonment. Yeah. Especially into the jhanas. Then using wisdom to eradicate the hindrances. Using wisdom to eradicate the hindrances, that will be eradication abandonment. That I didn't explain because we didn't actually come to that in the sutta yet. That's what comes in the section on the destruction of the taint in paragraph 25. So I have to revive that part of the diagram next week. Yeah. Okay, the word samadhi has a wider range than jhana. Samadhi, let's say jhana is a very eminent type of samadhi. But there is samadhi which is approaching jhana, short of jhana. Just when the mind becomes concentrated, even if you're practicing meditation, the mind becomes concentrated for a few minutes, so you're focusing quite clearly on the object, you could say that you're experiencing some samadhi. But you wouldn't call that a jhana unless you really get into a proper jhana in the sense of absorption. No, in jhana there's no insight in the sense of examining impermanence, examining a non-self. It's just complete absorption in the object. Yeah. There is awareness. Of course, there's very clear consciousness. Yeah. Extremely clear consciousness. Yeah. The difference between vitakka and vichara. I have to say it's very difficult to explain the difference between them. And in terms of experience, okay, one just has to sort of reflect back on one's own experience of, okay, suppose one is taking a kasina object. And I don't have very much first-hand experience with kasina. But just suppose, okay, a blue kasina, and one has the initial object, the blue disc. The vitakka will be that particular factor by which one is, again, one has to use these metaphorical words, applying the mind again and again, over and over, onto the object. applying the mind to that object, blue disc, blue disc, blue disc, blue disc. Vichara, if you just reflect sort of through a subtle shift in one's introspection, vichara is what is examining the blue disc, or looking at the blue, well, the eye is looking at it. Just examining the blueness of the blue disc, exploring vichara, turning the blue disc over and over in the mind. Yeah. It's not that vitakka turns into vichara. No, vitakka and vichara are distinct. What I would say is that at the beginning, vitakka is more prominent, because at the beginning one has to make a more determined effort to apply the mind at the object. And the examining of the object is more in the background. But once the object becomes fixed more clearly in the mind, then the applying of the mind to the object can soften. One could soften that function, and the examining of the object becomes comparatively more prominent. There's something I wanted to say, but then it's just, it'll come back. Yeah. Don't they become one? They never actually become one in the sense of being identical. In a sense, only in the sense that the object of the mind in the jhana, or even in the stage preceding the jhana, is a purely mental object. Now, one is not dealing with the physical object that one initially used as a basis for concentration. Once the mind reaches a certain level of concentration, that object falls away and one is able to pick up the mentally created object, which has been based upon that original physical object. And so then one takes a purely mind-created object, a purely perceptual object, and then that is the object of the concentration. In that sense, the mind and its object are one. Yeah. 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 I'd say it differs from person to person, but one does have to make effort. If one doesn't make effort, then one will slide away from the access concentration. But it's not a thing where you could really deliberately push yourself from access into the first jhana just by straining and struggling. It's just a matter of, you have to make an effort, but then it's a matter just of the faculties maturing on their own. Somewhat like if you have a delicate plant to grow it, you have to make the effort to give it proper water, to give it water, proper nutrition, but you don't make the effort for it to flower. It flowers when it reaches the proper. Now I remember what I wanted to add to Suki on the distinction between vitakka vichara. The commentaries give some similes, which again, similes are always to be taken with a grain of salt. They say, let's see, vitakka, it's like, you know, a compass for drawing a circle. Vitakka is like the point of the compass that you stick into the paper. Vichara is like the point that you use to turn around to make the circle. Or it's like, I think when drying a plate, vitakka is like the hand that holds the plate firmly. Vichara is like the hand that turns around to dry the plate. Another simile I don't like because it suggests a difference in time. Vitakka is like you strike a gong, then vichara is like the reverberation of the gong. I don't like that because it suggests a cause and effect relation between them, which is not the case. There were two more similes, I don't remember them. Yeah. I'm not quite sure that I get the point. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, where the concentration is on the object and doesn't disconnect, I'd say that's more characteristic of access concentration, not yet the jhana.
Yeah.
I say it's in that point where the concentration is on the object and doesn't disconnect, that's where the jhana factors are now starting to build up strength. But it's not yet the point where they're in the jhana. And also just to come to this point raised by Janet here, you know, about effort and energy, sometimes the way to bring about that quantum shift, it's not by pushing, but by softening the effort rather than pushing the effort. Because pushing the effort tightens the mind, and that creates agitation. But sometimes it's a matter of the mindfulness has to be there, but instead of pushing, then just keeping the observation, but softening and loosening the grip, seeming to loosen the grip on the object. But since mindfulness one is observing the object, but that loosening of the mind is what allows the concentration to deepen, and then the mind makes the shift. Yeah. That's a very good analogy. Okay, maybe one more question. I don't really know enough about Zen archery to say whether it's so or not. Okay, then we'll stop and continue next week. Okay, we do the sharing of the mirror. No snow today. What's happened? Snow Davis are taking a Tuesday off. Akasa ta chabumma ta deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditpa chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumma ta deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditpa chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabumma ta deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditpa chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata chamme sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamme sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamme